I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A Senate subcommittee is grilling current and former top executives from the two largest credit ratings agencies. Yesterday, a federal probe released internal emails from Moody's and Standard & Poor's showed that they cowed to pressure from clients like Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch and gave securities like those bundled subprime mortgages artificially high ratings to make them more attractive to investors. Jesse Eisinger is senior reporter for ProPublica. Jesse, this investigation into Moody's and Standard & Poor's began in late 2008, but the firms admitted back in 2007 that they overrated securities. So what's the significance of this large-scale investigation? Is it the emails?
Well, the issue is they admitted that they've gotten stuff drastically wrong, but they haven't admitted errors, but they haven't admitted negligence or doing something willfully incorrect in order to make a buck. And that's what the investigations are. And there are a raft of lawsuits, too, that allege that. And that's a much bigger business threat to Moody's, although the first thing, getting things disastrously wrong, should be a business threat to them. And it has hurt their business, but not terribly.
Well, and do these emails show us that they seem to know what they were doing, not just, you know, getting it wrong?
Well, there were a number of employees at S&P and Moody's who left the business over the course of 2004, 2005, 2006 because they were concerned that the businesses were turning toward helping Wall Street. One of the emails, one of the most damning emails, is the idea that they had Stockholm syndrome about their customers. And of course, they do. They are captured by their customers. The investment banks pay for ratings on these products, and these structured financial products are not like a corporate bond or a bond from a country. The structured financial products cannot exist without ratings, and the rating agencies were involved at the very beginning in helping construct these projects and giving feedback on these products to the investment banks. So there was a lot of back and forth. It was an iterative process, they say. So, you know, a corporate bond can exist without a rating, but these kind of mortgage-backed securities or CDOs cannot.
Well, Ian, you mentioned the Stockholm syndrome. That's from a 2006 email in which an S&P employee likened the rating unit to hostages who've been internalized, who have internalized the ideology of their kidnappers, and the kidnappers being these issuers like Goldman Sachs. What were some of the other emails?
There have been emails that have come up before where they said it could have been structured by cows and we would rate it. And then here now they're talking about adjusting criteria for rating CDOs because they're worried about losing deals. There are a lot of damning emails here. It's not surprising. But the question really is there going to be any change in the business from this? Will the lawsuits go anywhere? Will the investigations go anywhere? And one troubling thing is that the rating agencies have been Not only are they included in thousands of laws and regulations in the country's laws right now, but they were sort of further codified in the Treasury and the Federal Reserve's programs to recapitalize the banks. And so those relied greatly on ratings. So the rating agencies have been, if anything, even further established in the firmament of our financial markets instead of what we should be doing, which is, you know, decoupling them, trying to separate out the markets from the grip that the rating agencies have because they're really not competent at their job.
Well, is there anything in the financial regulation that might do that? As you said, at one time, the ratings agencies were paid by the investors, people who wanted to get this information. Now they're paid by the very companies that are issuing the securities. Is there any suggestion that they, as you say, be decoupled?
There is none, as far as I understand it right now. The rating agencies have sort of been sidelined. There are a lot of enormously important issues that have not been sidelined, like capital requirements and derivatives legislation. But for now, I believe that the rating agencies have largely been ignored. in the financial regulatory reform, and that's a shame because this is a very important issue and central to the crisis, and oddly been neglected up until now. Really, you know, there have been a bunch of congressional hearings, and they sort of, it periodically flares up and then dissipates, and this may be a point of flaring up, and it may be something that will lead to some substantial change.
Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter for ProPublica, as two rating agencies, Moody's and S&P, testify in Washington today about what they knew about the securities and other financial instruments they gave top ratings, but as we now know, failed. Jesse, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for having me again, Robin. Bye.
Well, hundreds of thousands of teachers around the country are facing layoffs this June. Illinois is predicting 17,000 cuts. New York City says nearly 15,000 teacher jobs could disappear in June. As many school systems wrap up spring break, we want to take a look at a couple of topics that will be the buzz when they get back on Monday. In a few minutes, a call for something like the Manhattan Project to find out why there's still such an academic achievement gap. But first, it's hard to imagine that project happening when schools can't even afford teachers. Tamara Lewin is national correspondent for The New York Times. You can see her reporting on this issue at herenow.org. But Tamara, give us some more of the numbers of these possible teacher cuts.
Oh, it's really grim this year. California is the worst. That's going to be over 20,000 teachers. And that's just really an almost unfathomable number, particularly because it isn't just teachers. It's going to be assistant principals and custodians and school psychologists and social workers and all the people that also keep the classroom going. And it's getting rid of full-day kindergarten, and it's getting rid of, oh, all the things like free sports in middle schools, and lots of programs will be gone, too. It's just going to be a very austere year.
Well, Tamara, why is this happening? We know California has had financial problems, but we also know that part of the stimulus money was to go to keep teachers' jobs.
This year, we had $100 billion of stimulus money, and that's been supporting 5.5% of all the school jobs, and that's running out. So that's a big problem right there. And then you couple that with the fact that the state budgets are in terrible, terrible shape, so they're having to cut more, and schools are the biggest thing they fund. And then you add on top of that the fact that since people aren't doing very well in their own personal lives, when they go to the polls to vote about their school district budgets, they're voting them down this year. So New Jersey, just last year they'd said, yeah, three-quarters of the tax increases to support schools were good. This year they voted most of them down. No. So schools don't have anywhere more to turn.
Well, give us some more examples. Let's say North Carolina.
Well, you have the Charlotte-Mecklenburg district where they keep saying, you know, the problem here is that it's cumulative. So we cut a whole lot last year, and the stuff you cut, you can't cut again. So then you're cutting deeper than you ever thought you'd cut. So in Charlotte and Mecklenburg, they're getting rid of another 600 or 700 teachers, and they're moving to things that the superintendent said, I know these really aren't the right things to do, but I don't have any choice anymore.
Well, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, you quote him, he says that state budget cuts may imperil 100,000 to 300,000 public school jobs. And of course, you know, we're talking about teachers. He says it's an emergency. Okay, if it's an emergency, what's to be done?
Well, there's a couple things that could happen. We're at the part of the year where we hear the most dire predictions. So, for example, in Arizona next month, they're going to vote on a penny sales tax. And if they agree to that, that'll go a long way toward making things easier. All over the country, there's still more votes to come. And there's a lot of teacher union negotiations to come, which could make things a little easier. Meanwhile, in Congress, Senator Harkin has introduced a sort of another round of stimulus money. It's a Keep Educators Working $23 billion package. I don't know that that has too much chance of passing because it's not funded, and we don't know where that money would come from either. It's also a time when people are saying, you know, districts are really going to have to accept that this is the new economic reality, and they're just going to have to learn to live with less. So I'm not sure that we aren't seeing a real structural change. And some of the kinds of wonderful programs and school reforms that we've done, may be kind of falling by the wayside. Class sizes are going to be introduced. It's going to be quite a different world.
Well, and we want to be clear, we're not talking about the No Child Behind issue, the scramble by states to get federal money if they raise performance levels, and the story that came out of Rhode Island of an entire staff of teachers being fired because of performance. This is about economics. And you mentioned teacher talks. Is there a sense that, you know, if teachers take cuts in pay, there might be less job cuts?
There might be a little less job cuts. The other big issue here that I'm not sure how much people are talking about yet, but they're going to be, is the seniority rules, which basically say, you know, if you're the newest hired, you're the first out the door. But some of the most innovative schools, for example, in Cleveland, there's a set of innovation schools that are performing especially well, and they tend to have the younger, newer teachers, and there's one that may lose all of its teachers.
Well, meanwhile, there are other school districts that are trying to think of some of these innovations. Some would say innovations, others might say things that will drastically and negatively change the school experience. There was a district in Minnesota that's talking about the shorter school week.
That was one of the real shocks recently. It used to be that we were all sort of moving along toward all-day kindergarten. Now 13% of the schools say they're considering going to half-day kindergarten because they just can't afford full-day kindergarten. A lot of people are thinking about four-day weeks. I think that actually may have been the 13%, but that's become a kind of a mainstream thought, a four-day school week. Several states are shaving a couple days off the school year. It's less education, which is, of course, at a time when we're all thinking, well, how do we do better on education? But you can't do improvement when you're going to have a lot less money and a lot less people.
Just want to underscore that it was the school district of Atwater Cosmos Grove City in Minnesota that's asked permission from Minnesota to have a shorter school week.
But that's already happening. They wouldn't be the first in Minnesota. They would be the fourth in Minnesota.
But Tamar, we want to know, you say there are a few places that are thriving. Where are they and why?
Well, they're little pockets around the country, but there's that little pocket of Montana and North Dakota. Their state budgets are in good shape, so their schools are in good shape.
Tamar Lewin is national correspondent for The New York Times. She's been following how schools are struggling because of budget shortfalls, and it looks like teachers, thousands of them, may be losing their jobs by June. Tamar, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So there is a budget crisis, but nonetheless, just ahead, we'll speak with a Princeton sociologist who's crunched the numbers on affirmative action. He says, don't forget another urgent moral crisis, the racial gap in academic achievement. He wants to put a lot of money into solving that one. We'll hear his thoughts. Coming up later in the program, an unbelievable story of what one astronomer reportedly saw through his telescope back in the mid-1800s. And Boston maestro James Levine is recovering nicely from surgery. We're glad to hear that. But it got us to thinking, who are the other bright lights in conducting across the country? We'll have that later. Back in 1 minute as we continue our look at schools here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've just heard about the financial crisis affecting schools. Nonetheless, our next guest says there's another crisis, the racial gap in academic achievement, and we need to invest in a huge project like the Manhattan Project that created the atom bomb to address it. Princeton sociologist Thomas Espenshade is co-author of No Longer Separate, Not Yet Equal, Race and Class in Elite College Admission and Campus Life. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
You've crunched the numbers on SAT scores, and you've come up with some striking statistics. Why don't you tell us those first?
One of the things that we looked at was the extent to which underrepresented minority students are given a boost in the selective college admission process, and we've tried to convert the strength of these boosts into their SAT score equivalents. For black students, the extent of the preference or boost is equivalent to 310 SAT points on the old 1600 scale. The strength of the boost for Hispanic students is about 130, and Asian applicants compared to whites experience an Asian disadvantage equivalent to about 140 SAT points.
In other words, they have to score that much higher to be considered?
Yes.
Well, a couple of things. As you well know, this kind of information feeds into the belief that blacks, for instance, can't achieve, that this has to do with their race, because you're looking at, you know, a racial group. So what are you saying?
There isn't any evidence that underrepresented minority students can't achieve. One of the things that we have found is that the college preparedness of underrepresented minority students isn't on the same par on average as it is with white and Asian students. But this has to do with schools that students attend, with child-rearing practices. Some of these gaps in achievement show up even before students set foot in a school. So it has to do more with family environment, school environment, neighborhood environment, and not with an innate inability to achieve.
Well, hold that thought, because that comes up later in your proposal for a Manhattan Project. You know, people are saying, well, we know this. So hold that thought. Another criticism comes from a blogger named John Rosenberg, who says that what you have found, in essence, is discrimination against Asians.
I don't think it's appropriate to interpret our findings as discrimination against Asian applicants in the admission process. In the statistical analysis that we've done, we have only partial information, some of the harder pieces of evidence like scores, students' race, what kind of high schools they went to, but we don't have some of the softer variables, teachers' letters of recommendation, extracurricular activities, and things of that sort.
Well, you know, that brings up another question. Why focus on test scores? Because you even say quite eloquently that merit is kind of a moving target. At one point, women had no merit. A hockey player, you write, may have more merit at a school that's losing their star hockey player than at a school that doesn't have a hockey team. You'd have no merit there. Why focus on SAT scores when many schools are actually focusing less on them?
I agree very much that merit is a malleable concept. Which candidates have the best chance of advancing an institution's mission? And one of those institutional missions is to create a very diverse group of undergraduates, not just racially and ethnically diverse, but socioeconomically, regionally, and so forth. The reason that these numbers about SAT score equivalence, I think, have gotten so much attention is what we have tried to do is to convert the strength of the boost for underrepresented minority students into some scale that most people would readily recognize. We could have used any other scale.
Well, the point is that you discover that there is a boost, and that brings you to your conclusion that doing away with that kind of a boost would mean that underrepresented minorities would not attend college as much. And this is your concern and why you've come to the conclusion that there needs to be this new Manhattan Project. So you want one of these new, huge, vast projects. What do you envision?
This would be a project that would have two basic aims, both of which surround this concept of the racial achievement gap, a gap in skills and knowledge that really begins almost from the day kids are brought home from the hospital. By the time students enter kindergarten, black kids are on average about a year behind. By the time students reach the end of high school, black kids are on average about 4 years behind white kids. This racial achievement gap we refer to as the most pressing domestic issue facing the United States at the beginning of the 21st century, not just because it has implications for selective colleges and universities, but also because it has important ramifications for the competitiveness of the U.S. economy, the quality of the U.S. workforce, other patterns of adult inequality.
We asked you to hold a thought from earlier in the conversation, which was that we sort of know why this happens. Some of your other critics say that kids from two-parent homes we know do better. In the non-Hispanic black population, over 70% of children are born out of wedlock. We know that's a problem. We know that much of this has nothing to do with Jewishness or Asianness. George Leaf says that. He says it's about family culture. It's not DNA. It's values in the home. We know this. Why do we need a Manhattan Project?
We know some of these things in part. What we don't have is an overall picture of what factors influence the racial achievement gap, how and when these factors come into play to influence how and when these gaps develop, And most importantly, we don't know what the relative importance of the various factors is, so we don't have a consensus on the most effective intervention strategy.
And what do you say to white parents, many of whom, as you well know, are furious that the focus isn't on their kids who have the higher SAT scores than, say, the black or Hispanic child, maybe first generation to go to college? How would a Manhattan Project help them?
Well, I think a focus on this Manhattan Project would do a lot for K through 12 education in general, and not only narrow these gaps, but act to lift all boats and improve the quality of academic performance among all students. One of the things that the No Child Left Behind Act did was to improve the scores of all students. Unfortunately, it didn't do much to narrow the gaps between different racial groups.
Thomas Espenshade, professor of sociology at Princeton, co-author of No Longer Separate, Not Yet Equal, Race and Class in Elite College Admission and Campus Life, putting out a provocative thought, let's have a Manhattan Project to see what can be done about the racial gap in academic achievement. Professor Espenshade, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, still ahead today, from James Levine to Gustavo Dudamel, what makes a good orchestral musical director? But the latest news is next, Here and Now. President Obama used a citizenship ceremony for 24 active duty service members today to weigh in on Arizona's controversial immigration bill, which would require police to ask people about their immigration status if there's reason to suspect they're in the country illegally. The president said the government must enact immigration reform at the national level or leave the door open to more of what he called misguided efforts like Arizona's. The president's comments ramp up the pressure on Arizona's Republican Governor Jan Brewer. She faces a deadline tomorrow to act on the bill. Let's check in on all of this. Mark Brody is covering the story for KJZZ and joins us from the station in Phoenix. So, Mark, is the governor expected to act, and what are her options?
Well, she basically has three options. She can either sign the bill, she can veto the bill, or she can let it become law without a signature, which would basically mean she doesn't do anything. The deadline, as you said, is tomorrow at midnight. Sort of the conventional wisdom is that she will act on the bill today at some point. The other conventional wisdom is that she is likely to sign the bill. But again, we haven't heard anything from her. We haven't heard anything firm on that. That's just sort of word around the campfire.
Well, I thought that at some point Governor Brewer and others were saying that Arizona is forced to act because the federal government won't.
Yeah, last night she unveiled a border security plan. Yesterday afternoon, she unveiled a border security plan, which basically involves asking the federal government for some more resources and shifting around some resources that are already in the state. And one of the things that she did, as her predecessor did before her, was to complain that the federal government isn't doing enough to secure the border, that securing the border is a federal responsibility. The state can't and shouldn't have to pay for it, that the Fed should be doing this. So that's certainly is part of the discussion.
Well, and this is what President Obama is saying, that the federal government should act on immigration reform. The bill was put forth by Republican Senator Russell Pierce of Mesa. Tell us more about it and why it's so controversial.
Well, the bill it's been described as a sweeping bill. There's a lot in here. The most prominent provision would have police officers, if they have reasonable suspicion to believe that someone is in the country illegally, basically ask them for their documentation. The bill would also require police departments to allow their officers to fully enforce federal immigration law. It would make it a crime to work or solicit work if you're here illegally. It would make it a crime to block traffic if you're trying to pick up a day laborer or if you are a day laborer looking for work. So there's a lot in here that deals with a lot of different elements of internal immigration enforcement.
Well, and the part that allows police to ask people who are suspects for proof, it for a lot of people that smacks of, you know, where are your papers? But how do supporters of the bill respond to that?
Well, what they say is that racial profiling is illegal. It says in the bill it's illegal. It already is illegal. And the bill also says that race cannot be the sole determining factor in deciding if a police officer has reasonable suspicion. Now, it can be a factor, just not the only factor. So supporters say that police do this sort of thing all the time. They have discretion. We give them discretion to do these sorts of things. So we need to trust the police officers to know what they're doing. As you said, the critics are saying, you know, this is just going to legalize racial profiling, and you're going to be ending up arresting a lot of people who are legal U.S. citizens.
Well, Mark Brody, this also figures into Arizona politics. We have about a minute left, and that would never cover Arizona politics. But we know you've got a governor's race coming up, and also John McCain facing a challenge from J.D. Hayworth in the Republican primary. So I'm sure this issue is in the middle of all of that.
It certainly is. For reporters, our email inboxes have been flooded with statements from different political leaders and campaigns and candidates. The governor's, you mentioned she's in a Republican primary. The three sort of other top candidates in that primary have all come out in favor of this bill. The Democrat who's running for governor has come out opposed. Both Senator McCain and candidate Hayworth have been talking about this. So you're right. It is a very big part of the political scene here.
Mark Brody with KJZ. In Phoenix, Arizona. And as he says, Governor Jan Brewer is expected to sign the controversial immigration bill there, perhaps as soon as today. Mark, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take a quick break and then hear your letters and an unbelievable story. Keep that word unbelievable in mind. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Let's hear from a few of you. Our April 14th segment on a push by gun rights activists to carry their guns in public drew a lot of response. Shedrick Sanders of Chicago, Illinois, called us to say he's against it because he discovered while attending a Citizen Police Academy training seminar that handguns only hit their target about 15% of the time.
If we have trained professionals out here and they can't use guns effectively, how do we expect common everyday citizen to protect them? And out on the street, the word is the safest person is the person being shot at, because most people can't shoot a target.
Well, Angel Schroeder of High Point, North Carolina, also had an opinion. She wrote, I nearly wrecked my car when the gun rights activist John Pierce of OpenCarry.org compared denial of carry permits to the civil rights movement. This attitude of persecution is, frankly, delusional, but I really appreciated the opportunity to hear a viewpoint I oppose. A correction, I recently welcomed new listeners at KNCH in a town in Texas. Sherry Gonzalez of San Antonio was one of many who wrote to say, you mangled it. So we decided to call Eve Keim from the Visitor Center in, Eve, how do you say it?
San Angelo.
San Angelo.
That's right.
San Angelo.
I've always just kind of rolled it together, kind of like New Orleans. You know, we just do San Angelo.
San Angelo.
Mm-hmm.
Sherry tells me, think angels, not jello shots, which I prefer to do anyway, but it's not San Angelo.
No.
Okay, San Angelo.
San Angelo.
And finally, Holly Garan wrote after our sit-down with Steve Almond, author of Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life, a memoir of his decades-long love affair with music. It prompted Holly to send us a poem about how rock and roll connected her with a son in what sounds like a precarious time. Here's the last stanza of her poem, which is called A Little Left. There wasn't enough. I can see that in the children's eyes staring in photos, their needs an ocean that overwhelmed me. When the envelopes to pay bills were filled each month, just a little left. One son won a road race, earning a Thanksgiving turkey. Another son I barely saw gave me songs in the key of life. She writes, they joyously listened together. One last correction. Yesterday, Kelly Beatty from Sky and Telescope magazine misspoke. He said the Hubble telescope shows us pictures from 800,000 years after the Big Bang. He meant 800 million years. We'd love to hear from you. Just go to hearandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or make a phone call. Or you can leave a comment right there, hearandnow.org. Let's flip the calendar back a bit. The Hubble is celebrating its 20th anniversary. But on August 25th, 1835, people opened the morning edition of the New York Sun to read about another seemingly remarkable telescope. Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace podcast tells us this story of the unbelievable discoveries of British astronomer Sir John Herschel. Observations of the moon, at least as reported in the Sun.
John Herschel was the son of Sir William Herschel, who had earned the Sir in front of his name by discovering the planet Uranus and two of its 27 moons, which is impressive stuff. But there, in the pages of the New York Sun, it seems that Sir John had been outshone by his own son. The younger Herschel had cracked several problems of physics and optics and mechanics and managed to build the most powerful telescope in the world, an instrument that promised to answer questions that had bedeviled every person who had ever looked up at nighttime. Sir John Herschel pointed it at the moon. There were beavers there. There were rolling fields of deep crimson flowers, forests of trees, blue unicorns with beards like goats who romped and tumbled in the grass like kittens. Over the course of 5 days, the wonders of the moon were cataloged in the pages of the Sun. On Wednesday, its readers learned of the vast herds of bison, which stampeded through a valley carved out long ago by a volcanic eruption. And of the moon beavers, which weren't really beavers, they had no tails, they walked upright, and they lived in huts more impressive, as the article put it, than those of many human savages. And on Thursday, people opened up the Sun to read of Herschel's most phenomenal discovery yet. At first, he and his team thought they were birds. They were clinging to a cliffside. They were gliding in flocks just above the waves of a great inland sea. But they weren't birds. They were men. They were men with wings. Vespertilio Homo, the scientists called the new species. Batmen. And there were bat women, too, who flew and frolicked in a state of nature that looked incredibly appealing when viewed through a 15,000-pound telescope lens by buttoned-up British scientists. So this is the point of the story in which I say that none of this was true, which you know already, that this was all a big hoax. And we here in 2010 can laugh at our gullible ancestors. And though we can't know for sure, it seems that they did believe it for the most part, at least for the first four articles or so. After a while, it seems the incredible details just weren't credible. And there was a Sir John Herschel, and he was a very accomplished scientist, discovered moons around Saturn and, like his dad, around Uranus. But he didn't discover that he was the man in the moon hoax until years later. And apparently he found the whole thing sort of irritating. So we can laugh at our gullible ancestors, but I'd rather not. Because why not believe? Who was to say at that point what was on the moon? These were people who were reading about wonders, real wonders, all the time. About new technical marvels, sewing machines and electric motors and matches and streetcars. Reading dispatches from expeditions to the Four Corners, telling of bizarre animals named and new peoples met, of new languages heard and new rituals observed in Africa and Asia and Australia and South America. And in a time before cars and transcontinental railroads and the 40-hour work week and summer vacations, who's to say there weren't wonders just upstream or over the next ridge? So who was to say there weren't rolling fields of poppies on the moon, or great pyramids of quartz, or red birds that made their nests in flowering palm trees on the shore of an inland sea, or giant beavers who lit fires to keep their huts warm? Okay, maybe they should have figured out when they read about the beavers. The beavers are ridiculous.
To hear more stories from Nate DeMeo and the Memory Palace podcast, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Before we go, look at some of the bright lights of the classical music world. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. The Boston Symphony Orchestra's Grammy-winning performance of Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe, under the baton of musical director James Levine, who just last week underwent yet another back operation. Today we're told that surgery was a success, but Levine will miss the rest of the spring season, which got us to thinking, what exactly does a conductor or musical director do? Levine was both. Joining us in the studio with the answer is classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz. Longtime listeners know him for his commentaries on NPR's Fresh Air, but we share him. So, Lloyd, thanks so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Robin.
And give us a sense of, you know, why everybody talked about a void at the BSO without James Levine. I mean, how big a presence was he?
Well, huge. And he's someone who came in really to take over the orchestra and make it a significantly better orchestra. In terms of performance, in terms of programming and scheduling, in terms of bringing in good soloists to appear in the various performances. And he did that.
And we should say, in case someone's just tuned in and is saying, what? What's going on? Maestro Levine isn't scheduled to go anywhere else anytime soon. But it's gotten people thinking about, you know, who are the new hot conductors and musical directors on the scene now? And, of course, the one that leaps to mind is Gustavo Dudamel. As he's the newly appointed director of the L.A. Philharmonic. He's 10. No, he's he's 29. He's so young. He's Venezuelan. Here's some of his sound. Now, Lloyd Schwartz, I know people who have given up everything to go join the cult of Dudamel, the
right.
Dude, the new dude of classical music.
Right.
Your thoughts?
I think he's a wonderful musician. He really thinks about what he's conducting. I think he has a great ability to communicate that both to the players and to the audience. My reservation about him has to do with one of the other jobs that a music director has to do, which is raising the level of the orchestra, raising the level of the playing, of the interpretations, and programming. I happened to be in London two summers ago when he led a performance with his previous orchestra. It was a Swedish orchestra that he had been directing for several years. And I actually thought the playing was extremely disappointing, not very skillful, not very tight, and I didn't like the program that he was presenting. Now, the LA Philharmonic is a very good orchestra, so he probably doesn't have to worry about poor playing, but he is going to have to be very involved with programming and scheduling music. And he's not really proven himself in that capacity yet.
Well, so there's sort of a wait and see on some aspects of Dudamel. But another one of your favorites is the former sort of child star, if you will, which is Michael Tilson Thomas, the musical director of the San Francisco Symphony. Let's listen to a little of his performance of Mahler's Symphony No. 8 in E-flat major.
He really took, when he came in to take over the San Francisco Symphony, he did do the work of transforming the symphony. He brought it to a higher level, and he had a brilliant idea for programming. I mean, he had an idea of doing a Mahler cycle before everyone else in the world was doing one, and of recording live performances. So in some way, he really succeeded in putting the San Francisco Symphony on the map in a way that it had never been before.
Yeah, I'm thinking also of Maren Alsop, the musical director of the Baltimore Symphony. She appears with Scott Simon on NPR all the time. Here's a little of her conducting Brahms' Hungarian Dances. Lloyd Schwartz, I thought you were just going to sweep me away just then. You start moving to the music. But what would you say is notable about Maren Alsop's style?
She also seems to be a very good conductor. She's come a long way in a relatively short time. And she's also done something that is a very good thing for a music director to do, which is to get recording contracts for the orchestras, because fewer orchestras are recording anymore.
When we asked you, because of Levine's illness, to talk about who you saw as the bright lights of conducting, you were a little pessimistic. Are you saying what, that you don't think there are enough? Or?
Well, there aren't a lot. Maybe there never were. You know, how many great choreographers are there ever at one time in history? There's Balanchine, there's Mark Morris, there's Alvin Ailey, but, you know, there aren't a lot. And maybe on the very highest level, there are never a lot of candidates. The only other thing that I maybe needs to be said is that although it's fun to speculate about who's out there, because of the music business, everyone's under contract for so many years in advance that it's really hard to get replacements, certainly at short notice.
Well, still in all, can you pick another light on the horizon that we haven't talked about to go out with, some conductor you think we should know about?
The young Canadian, French-Canadian conductor Yannick Nezet-Séguin. I saw the Carmen, which he was conducting, and Carmen, everyone's heard it, and it can be really stale or really obvious. And his conducting, I thought his conducting was actually the most exhilarating aspect of that production. So I'm very high on him.
That's Lloyd Schwartz talking about some of the bright lights in the classical conducting world. Lloyd, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin. It was a pleasure to talk to you.